with us.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The nuclear power industry should be renamed the cancer industry. That's the view of paediatrician Helen Caldicott in her talk at Eastern Community Centre last night. Radiation, which will persist for over 500,000 years, continues pouring out of Japan's stricken Fukushima Daiichi plant. All fishing is halted as the surrounding sea is now tens of millions of times over the safety limit. Chris Busby is another sceptical expert, and he gives us the latest inside analysis from behind Fukushima's veil of secrecy. And some people say money's like a drug, and that may not be the only drug some of the top banking dynasties are hooked on. And did the withdrawal of billions of drug cash by the Mexican drug lords cause the 2007 crash? Well, we're looking at how one banking dynasty may have become so powerful through buying up news and business data companies that it keeps its own name completely off the rich lists. The General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists for the last 10 years has been Jeremy Deer, but he's leaving to make way for the NUJ's first ever woman boss. We hear Jeremy's tub-thumping final speech to conference, the rarely heard journalist's eye view of Britain's media. But first, we have some details of BBC Radio 4 programme on next Thursday evening, which will be taking a close look at the proposed new nuclear power stations upwind of us. That's Radio 4, and it's a programme examining safety at Hinkley and other UK nuclear power stations post-Fukushima, with particular regard to the adequacy of the regulators. And you can hear that on Thursday, the 21st of April, that's next Thursday, on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. There's interviews there with John Large, who's a nuclear engineer, who helped build and design some of the Magnox power stations, Joan Gerling from Sizewell, Jim Duffy, and Stop Hinkley campaigners too. So that's BBC Radio 4 next Thursday, the 21st of April at 8 p.m, and that's programme's called File on 4. So, also we have news that there's a strike taking place next week at job centres. Thousands of job centre plus call centre staff will strike on the 18th of April after bosses refuse to improve working conditions and customer service. In a ballot of the union's 7,000 members in JCP's 37 call centres across the country, 70% of those who took part voted for strike action. The turnout was 43%. Following the strong result, the union agreed not to call any industrial action to allow for talks to take place, but those talks have failed to actually reveal anything, so that's why the strike is taking place on Monday. Now, Martin, could you just also give us an idea here of why this strike is taking place, because I know it's got to do with targets that these call centre people are being given in order to actually remove people from benefits.
I don't think it's the call centre people that have been given the targets. I think it's the actual job centres that have been given the targets, where people go in to sign on or what have you. Obviously, there's a great deal of discontent in the public sector, and particularly in the PCS dealing with the claimant count rising and their numbers of staff being cut back. I mean, they're at the front end of the crisis, really, and you can see that there, a lot of people aren't very happy about it.
Well, senior managers have shown little willingness to resolve this dispute. As I said, the action follows a well-supported two-day strike in January by more than 2,000 workers in seven newest contact centres who've been forcibly moved from processing benefit claims to handling inquiries by phone. The union wants to improve the levels of customer service in call centres and end the target-driven culture, which is what I was talking about, this whole thing of target-driven culture in public service, particularly by changing the way unrealistic average call times are used and introduce proper flexible working arrangements. It sounds to me as if they're being told you're only allowed to spend 2 minutes on each call, and obviously some of the calls may demand a lot longer than that.
Well, when you're dealing with something like somebody's legal right to a benefit, you can't just cut the call off. It's not like buying something over the phone. It's got to be each individual has to be treated as an individual and on their merits, because it's their legal right or not their legal right to have the benefit. And it may, some calls may be done in 2 minutes and some may take a lot longer. You can't actually lay that down as a pattern from above as you could if you're doing telesales, for example.
So one of the offices on strike is in Bristol at Lodge House, Fish Ponds Road. There will be a picket line outside the office from 7:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. on Monday. And that's from Steve West, PCS DWP Group Executive Committee. Now, on to the nuclear question. And last night there was a meeting at Eastern Community Centre. An audience was packed in. And the nuclear power industry should be renamed, we're told, the cancer industry. That's the view, anyway, of paediatrician Helen Caldicott. And I spoke to her before she started her talk at the Eastern Community Centre last night.
Helen Caldicott, paediatrician, founding president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. I was invited here because apparently they want to build a new, very large French reactor, dangerous one, very close to here, and another one as well. So these women asked me to come and speak, and I decided that I would because I would be in London, so I could come.
We've had quite a long history of nuclear around here, without incident.
They're not incidents, they're accidents. They usually don't report them, they're very secretive. You don't know how much radiation is currently routinely emitted from those reactors very near here. There is a high incidence of leukemia in children living around reactors. There's a very important study showing that, and solid cancers. I'm a paediatrician. And now we're right in the middle of Fukushima, the most ghastly, tragic accident the Earth has ever seen. It is ongoing. Heavens knows when it will end or if they will be able to ever control it.
What makes you think that it's this bigger than Chernobyl or Three Mile Island? That's a big claim to make.
No, come on. The IAEA and the Japanese government just said it was a level 7. I'm not making the claim. TEPCO and Japan is.
What's going to be the effect, do you think, then, of Fukushima? Why has it been such a disaster? What's actually going to be the effect on the Japanese people in the future, and maybe people abroad?
Well, I think it'll mean the end of nuclear power, certainly in Japan. And if there is a really big explosion, and the possibility still remains there could be, in any one of the three very damaged reactors or a cooling pool, and the wind's blowing south, that'll be the end of Japan. It will become so radioactive, much of it, that people won't be able to live there anymore, or else if they do, there'll be very high incidences of cancer and leukemia, genetic abnormalities and congenital deformities, as we are now seeing around Chernobyl and throughout Europe. A recent report by the New York Academy of Sciences, which translated 5,000 Russian articles into English for the first time, that were published and peer-reviewed, show that nearly a million people have already died from Chernobyl. Now, that was 86. That's an ongoing event, and people will continue to die for hundreds or thousands of years. 40% of Europe is currently radioactive. You don't know if you're eating radioactive food or not. You can't taste, smell or see radioactive elements. When they land in your body, in the bone or the liver or the lung, they produce a very high dose to a tiny volume of cells, which the nuclear industry call low-dose radiation, but it's actually very high for the cells affected. And years later, 20 years later, 30 years later, you may develop a cancer from eating the radioactive food, because the period of incubation for cancer is long. And when the cancer arises, it doesn't wear a sign saying, I was made by some radioactive cesium you ate that came from one of the reactors nearby, or from Chernobyl, or from Fukushima. But we do know that radiation causes cancer. No dose is low enough that it won't cause cancer. Each dose you get adds to your risk of getting cancer. It's cumulative. And we are seeing a lot of cancer lately, and we can't cure it.
Now, the nuclear industry would say the opposite. They say, actually, what they do is relatively safe, and that there are big benefits, such as the fact that it doesn't contribute to climate change. So why is what you're saying so at odds with what the nuclear industry is saying?
Because they lie. For money, I suppose, and power and prestige, you know. The Department of Energy call it hard energy in America. But solar and wind, that's soft energy, it's kind of feminine. There's a deep psychological entrancement with all things nuclear ever since they blew up the first nuclear weapon. That's to do with the male psyche, I believe. It is certainly hugely expensive. It now costs $12 to $15 billion to build a reactor in America. Hugely expensive. They can only operate for 40 years before they have to be shut down. They create massive amounts of radioactive waste, which virtually lasts for the rest of time and will induce epidemics of cancer, leukemia and genetic disease in all future generations as it leaks and concentrates in food chains. And also, nuclear power plants don't stand alone. They are undergirded by a huge industrial infrastructure. You have to mine millions of tons of uranium to get a little bit of uranium. How do you mine uranium? Oh, well, you have to use oil. Then you have to crush the uranium in a milling plant. How do you do that? Electricity made from oil or coal, probably. And then you have to enrich the uranium. Two huge coal-fired plants are used to enrich uranium. Then you have to build the reactor. Making concrete adds enormously to CO2 production. So they absolutely lie, and I'm very, very fed up with people, A, who don't know any radiobiology or medicine, who've never helped a child to die of leukemia or cystic fibrosis, which is my specialty, who are only into money and power, who are engineers or businessmen. If we lie in medicine, we get deregistered. We would be killing our patients if we didn't take the data seriously. This is too serious. You know, tobacco, they said for years didn't cause cancer. I hear that you've got a great big tower here built by one of the tobacco barons. He killed people. He knew he was killing people, probably. But at least smoking only kills the smoker. That's their decision to smoke and maybe get cancer at 42. But nuclear power leaves a legacy for all future generations, so children will be born deformed and with genetic disease and will get cancer at young ages. We can't do that. This is a cancer industry. Nuclear power is a cancer industry and a nuclear war industry, because any country that has a reactor makes 250 kilos of plutonium a year by fissioning uranium. Plutonium is not a fission product, incidentally, and you only need 2.5 kilos to make yourself a bomb. So it's a nuclear weapons industry as well as a cancer industry, period. I mean, what are we doing? And it was Einstein who said the splitting of the atom changed everything save man's mode of thinking. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. These men's midbrains haven't changed. And they need to change, or the women need to rise up and take over, because we're in danger of being annihilated, either with a whimper or a bang.
Why do you put it in gender terms between men and women? Is that really fair?
Yes, it is. I'm going to write a book called Why Men Kill, because it's usually the men that kill and the women let them. We're pathetic, absolutely pathetic. Why do we fall in love with alpha males? Does that go back to when we were troglodytes in caves? I don't know. Sociobiology is a fascinating subject, and E.O. Wilson writes about it at Harvard a lot. But, you know, did we need strong males to kill the saber-toothed tigers while we breastfed our babies in the caves? I used to fall in love with alpha males. I couldn't help it, you know. That was part of my physiology, biology. Do I need to mate with a strong guy so he'll look after me? All of these things need to be analysed and dissected, because if we can't find the cause of a disease, we can't cure it in medicine. We can only cure polio or prevent it when we found the polio virus. You've got to find the cause of a disease, and the world is in the intensive care unit. It's critically, acutely ill now. We are all physicians to a planet that is in the intensive care unit. And unless we rise up and take the world back from these corporations, which are intent on destroying the planet, we'll lose it. And we probably are the only life in the universe.
For most of us, it's a complete mystery. Can you tell us what actually has been going on at Fukushima?
It's very complex. They built six reactors on a very major earthquake fault. Now, number one, that was more than stupid. That was criminal. Number two, they had an earthquake. Number three, they had a tsunami. First of all, they lost their external electricity supply, and millions did, because of the earthquake. And therefore, the pumps that cool the reactors, and they require 1 million gallons a minute of water, 1 million gallons, and there are six reactors, they couldn't cool the reactors. So the diesel generators they have, which are emergency machines, they were flooded and destroyed by the tsunami, so then they lost all their cooling. When you lose the cooling, The intrinsic heat within the rods is so intense from the fission products that have been created by fissioning uranium, which is how you produce electricity by boiling water and making steam. Then the cladding of the rods made of zirconium reacted with air and produced hydrogen, and the hydrogen exploded. Simple as that. So we've had 70% meltdown in reactor one. We've had a total meltdown in reactor two, and it's melted through the floor of the containment onto the concrete floor, which could invoke another huge hydrogen explosion like Chernobyl. We've had a fairly big meltdown in reactor three. The cooling pool in reactor four, which has fresh fuel in it, it's called a swimming pool, is very hot and it's lost its water. And that has burnt too. And pieces of spent fuel rods, if you stand next to a piece of spent fuel rod for a couple of seconds, you'll die in 2 weeks with your hair falling out, vomiting and bleeding to death. Pieces of spent fuel rods are being found 2 miles from the reactor. This is an absolute catastrophe, and no one knows how to fix it. By putting seawater in to cool the reactors, there are 60,000 pounds of mud also in each reactor, come in with the seawater, and also lots of salt crystals, which is deforming the geometry of the reactor, and then that means they won't be able to control them. This isn't even in the textbooks. This is new. And you know what? We get this in medicine. We think we know what's wrong with you, and you come in with certain diseases, you're very sick, we put you in the intensive care unit, and something happens to you tomorrow that no one could ever have predicted. It's the same with nuclear power. And you know what? We've developed a technology with which we have to be infallible. And that's the weak link. We are fallible. And as Einstein said, nuclear power's a hell of a way to boil water.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, who was speaking last night at Eastern Community Centre, and she's an Australian paediatrician. Now, Martin, what are your thoughts after hearing that? Because what she's saying there essentially is that there really is no argument for nuclear power.
Well, as she said at the very end, Einstein said this is a hell of a way to boil water. And I remember in the 1970s, the French have probably got the biggest nuclear programme in Europe. I mean, they generate a very large proportion of electricity from nuclear power, and in the 1970s there was a drought in France, and because they've got water-cooled reactors, because the water table had fallen because of the drought, they couldn't actually cool the reactors and they had to switch them all off. So this high-tech, super-duper, all-singing, all-dancing technology is knocked out by drought.
Chris Busby is another sceptical expert.
The accident was really much more serious than anybody admitted at the time. And it's still more serious than people are admitting now. One of the problems, of course, is that you can't get close to the reactors because they are still fissioning. Many of the reactors are damaged to the point that fuel is coming out of them. And you just can't work under those conditions, and nor can electronic instruments work under those conditions, because what happens is that the microchips that run the robots just don't operate when the radiation field gets up to a certain level. If you look back into the history of Chernobyl, people tried to talk down the disaster. In some ways, I feel that this was because they couldn't quite believe it themselves. There was an element of psychological denial here. On the other hand, we do know that the nuclear industry is very powerful, it's a lobbying system, and there's an enormous amount of money running on the back of the nuclear industry through uranium shares and people who have shares in the development of nuclear and so on. So it would be an absolute disaster to have to admit that this was as serious as it was. And I think it is shockingly irresponsible, nearly criminally irresponsible, for these people to have talked down the accident in the way that they did. Because what will have happened is that people will have believed them and it will not have acted in such a way as to save themselves from radioactivity and radiation damage. There is serious contamination on the ground out to 100 kilometres, and there's less serious contamination out to 200 kilometres. There's significant contamination in Tokyo, and even to the south of Tokyo. So in calculations that I've made in the last 2 weeks, and I've just come back from Berlin where I gave a paper on this, in my estimation, on the basis of the risk model of the European Committee on Radiation Risks, about 400,000 people will develop cancer in the 200-kilometre radius if they are not moved out. We're talking about 7.8 million people living inside that 200-kilometre radius. I'm basing my predictions on the health effects of the Chernobyl accident. And I was in Berlin talking to researchers from the Chernobyl area who've been looking into the effects of the Chernobyl accident. And on the basis of those figures, it's possible to predict the number of cancers that will develop in Fukushima. And also along the coast, I have to say, because the marine sediment is now becoming contaminated and the shellfish will concentrate the radioactivity. It's an absolute disaster. Anyway, this is my prediction. And I gave you my prediction some time ago, and you remember I was proved right.
Indeed.
So here's my prediction again. I think that it will be like the Chernobyl exclusion zone and people will be kept out. I mean, it may be that they will say that you can go back and it's all safe and so forth, but I don't think that they will. And I don't think anybody believes them now anyway. My people in Japan tell me that there's an enormous rage in Tokyo and in the areas around Fukushima about the way in which this information has come out so slowly, and even some of this information could be shown to be wrong. I mean, we've been able to figure out that the IAEA data that they gave is actually not correct. They've downplayed the levels of contamination.
Chris Busby.
I mean, that just goes to show how vulnerable these things are. And there's a kind of precautionary principle, isn't there? You know, if something minor goes wrong, like a car, it kills the people that are in it and it may be a few people on the motorway. Something like Fukushima happens, there's a real potential. I was reading in the LEAP 2020 bulletin earlier, there's a real potential for the whole Tokyo region to be knocked out by this, which will absolutely scupper the world economy.
Well, how do you mean knocked out?
Well, I mean, there's an area of 30 million people around Tokyo. They might have to evacuate the whole area, like the Chernobyl zone. But this is Chernobyl zones in the middle of nowhere in the Ukraine. If this is Tokyo, which is a centre of the global economy, both financially and technically. There's already spare parts for electronic equipment all over the world are running out because Japanese firms are on short time as a result of partly of the tsunami and partly of the nuclear crisis. And you're making your systems incredibly vulnerable to failure. We need to design our systems to be robust against unexpected shocks. And the problem with nuclear technology is that you put all your eggs in one basket and then you drop the basket, and then what do?
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, despite 99% of television being rubbish these days, there are two good series on at the moment. Channel 4's saucy Thursday night satire 10 o'clock live is one of them, so do please catch an edition of that before it finishes in a fortnight. 10 o'clock live is also repeated tonight if you missed last night's. The other one, which is fast becoming unmissable, is on English language Freeview Cable and its satellite channel Russia Today. The Kaiser Report with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Some people say money is like a drug. That may not be the only drug some of the top banking dynasties are hooked on, but it looks now like the withdrawal of billions of dollars of drug cash by the Mexican drug lords may have been the prime cause of the 2007 crash. We go over now then to one of my top two current favourite TV programmes, Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert on The Kaiser Report.
The law only applies selectively to certain people. Some guys are just totally exempt from them. And you see this in this following headline, Max. How a big U.S. bank laundered billions from Mexico's murderous drug gangs. So this is the Guardian News, and they've done a deep investigation into the story that we've covered before, which is Wachovia Bank. And they were found to have laundered $378 billion, or 30% of Mexico's GDP in this time, of drug money.
The cocaine.
Of cocaine, yes. $378 billion.
$378 billion laundered through Wachovia, which of course now is owned by Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway. And of course, he's never talked about that either. And it's a huge part of the Mexican GDP. And the bank paid a fine.
Well, it's $378 billion in money laundering through the Casas de Cambio, and they paid a $110 million fine, or less than 2% of 1 year's profits from Wachovia. Wachovia started getting involved in these Casas de Cambio in 2004, just when the violence really started getting extreme in the Mexican drug wars. In April and May of 2007, 3 years later, Wachovia, as a result of increasing interest and pressure from the U.S. Attorney General's office, began to close its relationship with some of the Casas de Cambio. And then in July of 2007, all of Wachovia's remaining 10 Mexican Casa de Cambio clients operating through London suddenly stopped, July 2007. What happened in August of 2007?
The world credit crunch.
The world credit crunch began.
So what we see here is that the global banking liquidity is funded from the Mexican cocaine drug cartels. When somebody decided to go after them, they withdrew their liquid cash, because remember, in the global economy, it's all credit and paper money. There's actually no cash except for the drug money. They took the drug money off the market, and they crashed the global economy. The reason Bear Stearns went bankrupt, the reason Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, is because the Mexican drug cartel withdrew their cash from the market as a protest against the investigation. In other words, so Wachovia, if I'm following this correctly, they had to pay a fine. No further investigation was pursued, presumably because if they went after this story deeper, the Mexican drug cartel would threaten to withdraw the money again and throw the global economy back into a total standstill?
Well, I think they learned their lesson, because let's go on to the next headline. The bank run we knew so little about. This is from the New York Times' Gretchen Morgeson. And she looked at the Federal Reserve Freedom of Information documents that were released only last week. This is based on the Bloomberg News efforts to force the Fed to release information that who they were loaning money to at the Fed's discount window. And it turns out, according to Gretchen Morgeson, in August 2007, as world financial markets were seizing up, domestic and foreign banks began lining up for cash from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. That August 20th, Commerce Bank of Germany borrowed $350 million at the Fed's discount window. 2 days later, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Wachovia each received $500 million. Now, banks only go to the discount window when they're in serious crisis and they're facing a liquidity crunch. Thus began, Gretchen Morgeson says, the bank run that set off the financial crisis of 2008.
That was Stacey Herbert there and Max Kaiser on the Kaiser Report on Russia Today. Now, Martin, do you think it's a bit far-fetched to say that they're actually now only now tracking down some of the reasons behind this 2007 crash?
Yeah, well, I think it's very people have got to realise that the international crime and the international banking system are completely interrelated. What subsequently happened was that as the banking crash got going, is that the UN Office on Drugs and Crime issued a report last year pointing out that the drug cartels came back to the banks and said, you need some money, we've got some, would you like some? And there was a big sucking sound as all of the illegal money was then sucked back into the system so that it didn't crash. And if you think back to the 1980s and the Iran-Contra affair, it was proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the US CIA was involved in drug dealing, as they had been in Vietnam and also in Afghanistan in the 80s. We've now got a situation where we've got the financial system, which is on the ropes, dependent on drug cash just to survive. And this, of course, is an absolutely intolerable situation and can't go on. In January last year, not this year, last year, two planes crashed in North Mexico full of cocaine. The last time those planes were seen was on the tarmac at Glasgow Airport, being used for extraordinary rendition by the CIA. Bank of Credit and Commerce International, CIA-run bank, massively involved in drug dealing. Eventually, we're going to have to confront the fact that we need to A, legalise drugs, B, disband the CIA, and C, reform the banking system.
Now, Stacey Herbert started that report by saying the law is only there for the small people.
That's right. I mean, the way it works is if you are running, as the CIA were running into Mena Air Base in Arkansas, plane loads of drugs, the only people that the DEA are after, the Drug Enforcement Administration, are the small guys. In Colombia during the 90s, the Cali cartel was cooperating with the Americans and with the government, and they were left alone. The Medellin cartel, Pablo Escobar, was outside the loop, and he was wiped out so that the Cali cartel could monopolise the market. You can't basically have illegal drugs without all of this dirty money, and the dirty money corrupts everything.
Martin Summers, thank you very much. Now we look at one banking dynasty, the Rothschild family. They may have become so powerful through buying up news and business data companies that they can keep their own name entirely off the official rich lists. In fact, 2 years ago in the Times rich list, the Rothschild family hardly made a blip. Only a subtle advert for Rothschild wine appeared on the first page of the rich list supplement. Some internet movies suggest the Rothschilds have used their immense financial clout to actually conceal the extent of their wealth.
Just how rich and powerful is Lord Evelyn Rothschild? Historically, the Rothschild family wealth was hidden in underground vaults. The Rothschild secret financial records were never audited and never accounted for. Their family commission biographies give the illusion that their family fortune has dwindled, but researchers estimate their wealth at close to $500 trillion, more than half the wealth of the entire world. Besides their many castles, palace mansions, wineries, racehorses, and exotic resorts, the Rothschilds bought Reuters in the 1800s. Reuters then bought the Associated Press, which selects and delivers the same news stories to the entire world, day after day. They have controlling interest in three major television networks and easily avoid media attention since they own it. Until recently, they owned and operated England's Royal Mint and continue to be the gold agent for the Bank of England, which they also direct. They control the LBMA, London Bullion Market Association, where 30 to 42 million ounces of gold worth over $11 billion are traded daily. The Rothschilds earn millions weekly just on transaction fees alone. They also fix the world price of gold on a daily basis and profit from its ups and downs. Over the centuries, the Rothschilds have gold bullion in their subterranean vaults and have cornered the world's gold supply. They own controlling interest in the world's largest oil company, Royal Dutch Shell. They operate phony charities and offshore banking services where the wealth of the black nobility and the Vatican is hidden in secret accounts at Rothschild Swiss banks, trusts, and holding companies. Although Evelyn Rothschild looks like a harmless gray-haired old man, make no mistake about it, Rothschild and his ancestors have handpicked presidents, crashed stock markets, bankrupted nations, orchestrated wars, and sponsored the mass murder and impoverishment of millions. The wealth hoarded by this one family alone could feed, clothe, and shelter every human being on earth. How did Evelyn Rothschild become the filthy rich Grand Vizier to Queen Elizabeth II and godfather of the black nobility? By birth, Evelyn Rothschild is the great-great-great-grandson of Mayor Rothschild and is passing the godfathership down to David de Rothschild.
The problem is the monopoly game, which is controlled by the Federal Reserve, the private bank, which is actually controlled out of London, is manipulating all the dollars to put more and more people into debt. So real estate is coming apart. The players that are analyzing everything are expecting massive foreclosures next year. It's going to be worse than 29. On my website, nohoax.com, right. Your house that you're living in, you think that's you right. Own it. You don't.
Right.
You have contractual right to transfer the airspace, subject to you paying taxes to the state.
Right.
Or the Global 2000 discussions that we had. The real problem that they have, as Kissinger says, is there are just too many people on the planet.
Now, this is a slightly disjointed look at stuff there, Martin, but I mean, the Rothschild family that we talked about at the beginning there, they're just one dynasty of many banking dynasties. Do you think that there's something going on here where these people are, as we were saying before, sort of above the law and, you know, to such an elitist extent that they're kind of distant from the rest of us?
Well, quite obviously they are, and that's the point I was going to make. It's not just the Rothschilds, because that sounds like it's a kind of a plot for some kind of sci-fi movie or something. If it wasn't the Rothschilds, it would be somebody else. It's the system which allows the Rothschilds to do those things, and if it wasn't them, it would be somebody else. I mean, JP Morgan is not Rothschild. They have their own nefarious activities going on, and no doubt there are struggles at the top between various factions.
But there also must be collusion between some of the big houses too.
Yes, indeed. But look at the way Lehman Brothers were hung out to dry. They weren't sufficiently in the loop to be protected, whereas Goldman Sachs was. These are palace revolutions, you know, fights at the top, which the outside world doesn't really know what's going on, who's winning, who's losing, how the policy is being determined.
So
but the real problem is the system. They shouldn't be allowed to make money like this.
We've got to the stage now where these dynasties are the true rulers of the world rather than the governments that we elect.
Well, they always were. Let's face it, democracy is a very recent invention and rather weak. Historically, societies have generally been run by the wealthy and powerful. Look back through history, you'll find your Henry VIII, your Hitlers, your Mussolinis and so on. I mean, democracy is actually rather the exception, although people imagine that, that it's the rule. It's not the rule at all, and democracy is always very weak. The powerful are the powerful. Democracy is some kind of check on their power, and of course it's got weaker and weaker as the power at the top in the hands of the wealthy has got stronger. I mean, that's what's happened in the last generation. They've got stronger rather than weaker.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Okay, sorry for interrupting you there, Martin. You're just finishing your final little flurry. But the General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists for the last 10 years has been Jeremy Deer, but he's leaving to make way for the NUJ's first ever woman boss. He knows as much as almost anyone in the country about the state of Britain's media from a writer's point of view, rather than from that of the media editors, managers and owners. So let's have a listen to Jeremy's final speech to conference, a journalist's eye view of Britain's media you will not hear on any other radio station.
Jeremy Deer, General Secretary, moving. Moving for the final time, annual report section 2. Comrades, if we needed any more proof that George Osborne's big lie that we are all in this together was so glaringly untrue, today is the day. As EU finance ministers tell us deep and damaging cuts are the only option, another city firm is announcing increased bonuses for financiers and speculators. George Osborne insists cuts in jobs, public services, pay and pensions are essential to bail out bankrupt Britain. And so, hundreds of thousands of public sector jobs are to be axed, with equivalent numbers lost in the private sector. And the price we are told we must pay include a tax on affordable social housing, billions of pounds of cuts in welfare, massive cuts in arts and leisure funding, education being priced out of the reach of students from less wealthy backgrounds, councils forced into having to make cuts in frontline services, and public bodies being axed, leading to less regulation just at the time we need more of it. And maybe the most pernicious of all the attacks, the idea that more than 1 million people on employment and support allowance must find work in 12 months or face a cut in their benefits at a time when millions are already out of work and more job cuts are to follow. One thing is clear. This is not just trimming back on the fat of a bloated public sector. It is a fundamental attack on the welfare state. And the very idea that this is a price worth paying or that must be paid is one of a number of myths being peddled by government. So let's just smash some of those myths here. The myth that the public sector is to blame for this crisis. We are in debt, not because firefighters put out too many fires, or teachers educated too many students, or nurses treated too many people who are sick, but because the profit at all cost greed of the bankers sparked a recession. Bailing out the banks cost us £1.3 trillion. People working to provide public services did not cause this crisis and should not have to pay for it. And what about that myth that we're all in this together? We're not. While pay freezes and job cuts hit public and private sector workers, bonuses for UK executives continue to rise by 17% in the last year alone. Profits as a share of national income are at a 40-year high, while wages are at a 40-year low. Last year, the 1,000 richest people in the UK increased their personal wealth by £77 billion. Just half their fortunes could pay off the entire national debt. We are not broke. The money is in the wrong hands. And above all, we must smash the myth that there is no alternative. These cuts are a political choice. There is an alternative, and it could start with putting an end to tax evasion, which loses us £75 billion a year, or the tax avoidance, which costs us £30 billion. Reversing the lowering of corporation tax would bring in an additional £15 billion, and the Robin Hood tax, a tiny tax on global financial transactions, would raise a further £250 billion annually. And we must take on the myth, too, that a response to the crisis which involves cutting public sector pay and pensions, attacking welfare benefits, education and transport will lead us to recovery. It hasn't in Greece, and you ask our comrades in Ireland whether it succeeded for them. It has deepened the crisis. Spending in the public sector creates jobs in the private sector. And so whether on the March for the Alternative or the Better Fair Away campaign, we have taken our banners to the streets of Dublin, Glasgow, Cardiff, London, Belfast and towns and cities across this union. As Pete said, we have marched together. Now we must be prepared to strike together too. And we do so not just because we have a passionate belief in economic and social justice, but because these cuts also hit our members hard. At the BBC, they were used as a justification for the pensions robbery unveiled last year. The backdrop to the craven submission by BBC management to government demands for a frozen licence fee coupled with massive new spending commitments. The excuse used for the closure of language services and the axing of hundreds of jobs at the World Service and monitoring. Now they are the justification as we face the Orwellian newspeak of delivering quality first, which will cut 20% from BBC spending, threatening thousands more jobs and services. And if we are all in this together, how come BBC bosses are still getting £500,000 in bonuses? If we're all in this together, how come BBC bosses are retiring with £1 million plus payoffs? If we're all in this together, how come some BBC bosses are getting double-digit pay rises at a time of pay freezes for more than a third of staff? And how come at monitoring or the World Service, it is hundreds of frontline reporters, producers and news gatherers, not senior managers who disproportionately face the chop? And while the BBC considers plans to cut programme making and threaten the future of local radio, they spend £10 million a year on private sector consultants, employ six of the top 10 highest paid HR executives in the UK, and pay senior managers upwards of £50 million a year. Not just this year, year on year. And yet they tell us there is no alternative to their cuts. Well, let the BBC hear this well. We will not stand idly by while you wreck services and force skilled staff out of their jobs. We showed in the face of the pensions robbery, we were willing, ready and able to fight to defend our terms and conditions. And so we stand today, ready, willing and able to fight compulsory redundancies and to defend services at the BBC. But the BBC is not the only place that jobs and terms and conditions have been the victims of economic crisis or such corporate greed and rank hypocrisy has been on display, or where union resistance has made a difference. At NewsQuest, at Johnston Press, at Trinity Mirror, at Northcliffe, across books, magazines, commercial broadcasting and new media, pay freezes, job culls, attacks on freelance rates and rights, title closures, the axing of editions and specialists are just the latest visible manifestations of an industry beset by corporate failure and unbridled greed. The picket lines, the lobbies of shareholder meetings, the demonstrations at company HQs and the public protests are the visible manifestation of our rejection of their corporate vandalism. And as Sly Bailey and Paul Davidson and other media executives receive increased pay, bonuses and pension payments, is it any wonder journalists ask, what kind of a system is it that rewards the boss of a news organisation for sacking journalists, closing papers and losing readers? In the face of so much bad news, it is sometimes possible to think there is nothing we can do. This union and its members continue to prove, even in the direst economic circumstances, our collective action makes a difference. From Glyn Roberts' court case to the picket lines at the BBC Arabic service, from the securing of new jobs at Alpha Newspapers to defending jobs at Clyde and Forth Press, from the resistance of rights grabs at Bauer to securing holiday pay for freelancers at Al Jazeera, this union makes a difference. And we've shown over the past 18 months that our commitment to fight for journalists and journalism stretches from starting out in your career to retirement. We've hit the headline defending pensions, and as Pete has said, now we are taking up with greater vigour the campaign to end the abuse of work experience and the exploitation of unpaid labour. Our union's been at the forefront of that campaign for years, and now, alongside London Freelance Branch, we launched a new initiative, Cashback for Interns, with the first test cases against media companies who breach the national minimum wage legislation now in the courts. And I welcome this week's report from the Low Pay Commission, in part informed by the evidence that I was able to present alongside Bechtu and interns themselves at the Commission and directly to the Deputy Prime Minister, which calls for HMRC to crack down on non-payment of the national minimum wage. It is long overdue, but with HMRC facing job cuts and too few inspectors, we cannot rely solely on others to help us stop this abuse. And so from Parliament, to the workplace, to the courts, we remain committed to campaigning and acting to end this exploitation. Those who unlawfully exploit the dreams of young journalists looking for their first step on the career ladder should be clear. There are now no more hiding places. I've always wanted to say this to them, but see you in court. And yet another example of our union standing up for journalists and journalism and our action making a difference. Ask Charles Atangana whether we make a difference. A leading Cameroonian journalist, set upon by President Biya's security forces, arrested, stripped naked, beaten up and detained for 40 days, locked in a flooded cell and tortured to try to force him to reveal his sources. He refused. Suffering from malnutrition and food poisoning, Charles managed to persuade his captors to take him to hospital. Through bribery, he managed to escape. On his release, he continued to face death threats. He fled to the UK, somewhere he believed was a sanctuary for freedom of speech. He remains here, thanks to the work of the Glasgow branch in particular, initially, and the rest of the union following on. But he still faces deportation. And we must pledge here today our continued support for Charles's fight and for all those NUJ members still fighting the barbarity of the threat of deportation. And today we should also take the opportunity to pay a public tribute to all those trade unionists who 25 years ago stood out and stood up to the world's most powerful media magnate, who, backed by the courts, the police, much of the media, and a viciously anti-union government personified by Norman Tebbit and Margaret Thatcher, sought so brutally to break the power of the unions. The defiance and resistance of all those trade unionists continues to inspire me and so many others today. And that dispute had enormous consequences for so many individuals, but it had a wider significance too. Whilst the strike ended after a long, brutal year, the consequences of Murdoch's actions are still felt in every newsroom and every media company today. Whopping delivered newspapers into the hands of corporations and accountants. And other employers rushed to exploit the opportunities the assault on the unions opened up. When it comes to cutting costs and creaming off bigger profits, newspaper bosses followed Murdoch's example. And we see the consequences of that today. Wages for journalists slumped. Staff shortages mean far too many journalists are desk-bound. Instead of investing in quality journalism, reporters and specialists are increasingly forced to spend all day at their desks because it's cheaper and more productive, and rely more and more on second-hand facts, corporate, celebrity and political PR. The scrutiny of power and democratic accountability suffer. And while the media industry delivered year-on-year record profits, the corporate business model began killing journalism, cutting at what is perceived to be expensive, investigative, international and original news gathering. It is that vision of a compliant, corporate, profitable cost journalism at the expense of truth or journalistic ethics, which so many people stood against 25 years ago. And it is a stand a new generation are making again today. And there could not be a more important time for us to be making that stand. Whopping open the door to Murdoch to grab power. He has consistently used and abused his media dominance for his own business ends, buying political favours to suit his own corporate interests. But whilst politicians and those in power have prostrate themselves time and time again in the face of that power, from the caveats in the Employment Relations Act to the relaxation of media ownership laws, a new resistance has grown. And now he's making his latest power grab with the proposed takeover of Sky B, raising deep public interest issues. The merged company would have a reach of 52% of the adult population, with profound consequences, not just for media plurality, but for our democracy. Figures for news consumption show Sky would have a share more than double its next nearest commercial rival. Merging the first and fourth most dominant news providers warrants more rigorous scrutiny than Jeremy Hunt. Spinning off Sky News for a few years does not adequately address our concerns. Remember the caveats Murdoch gave over the Times, the News of the World, or the Wall Street Journal. They were lies designed to provide a fig leaf to politicians and regulators too scared, too corrupt, too reliant on Murdoch's favours to act in the public interest. Sky News will remain under Murdoch's effective economic control, and with economic control comes the threat of editorial control. So that takeover rightly stokes our fears about increasing monopolisation of the media. Too much control in the hands of too few is bad for democracy. And this episode could not demonstrate that more clearly. Murdoch helped secure the election of a government committed to marginalising public service broadcasting whilst allowing him to extend his power. Unminuted meetings and that now infamous Christmas dinner all add to a stench of corruption. All this at a time when claimants in the phone hacking scandal have been bought off. The company's chief executive refuses to attend parliamentary hearings, and more allegations have surfaced about the company paying police officers for information. Officers from the very same force charged with investigating claims of criminality in the News of the World. Never mind referring the matter to the Competition Commission, it is unacceptable that the merger is even being considered while such serious charges are outstanding. But we have a new and important opportunity. The phone hacking scandal, the cloak and dagger negotiations over merger, tax avoidance, the poisonous bile poured forth by parts of Murdoch's empire have awoken a new interest in the role of the media. We have a chance now to shape that debate, and at its heart must be a total rejection of the Murdoch philosophy, so eloquently set out by James Murdoch, that profit is the best guarantor of media quality and independence. It is not. The founders of the free press never thought that freedom of the press would only belong to those who could afford a press. They would have been horrified at the idea that if rich people determine there is not sufficient commercial value in news, that communities should be deprived of quality information and quality journalism. So we need action to save, build and sustain a new media. For years we've warned that profit-at-all-cost model and relentless drive for market share means the truth has too often become expendable, that journalistic ethics can be set aside, and that journalists are forced to cut corners and act against their conscience for fear of losing their job. The arrest of two journalists in the phone hacking scandal proves that point. We should welcome the debate opened up by this latest episode. It strengthens our arguments for a conscience clause, for the need for a new regulatory regime, which does not serve the interests of the media owners, but protects the public interest, and for a commission on media ownership. Such a commission should be charged with promoting alternative models. The union's been at the forefront of that debate over the past 18 months, from the excellent New Ways to Make Journalism Pay conference to the forthcoming conference on alternative models and cooperative publishing. We must continue to lead that debate, stepping up our campaigns for media reform and joining forces with all those citizens who want to extend media democracy, accountability and plurality, and against those who seek to crush it. Comrades, it is for all these reasons and so many more that I have been immensely proud and honoured to lead our union through the period of winning back recognition, rebuilding the union's collective strength, and steering it through the biggest economic and structural changes we've ever faced over these past few years. I've been fortunate to have the opportunity to serve the union I love at every level, from FOC to General Secretary, and I thank you and our members for having given me the chance to do so. And I've been fortunate too to stand alongside so many great and dedicated reps, so many people who give freely of their time and effort only so they can help improve the lives of their colleagues, and to work with so many committed and inspirational officials and staff. But there is one person above all I could not have done this without: Paula. She's been a comfort in times of trouble, an inspiration in the heat of battle, and an active member and rep who is constantly asked, what does Jeremy think about this offer, this campaign, this proposal? To which she now replies, I don't know, I haven't decided yet. I see every day, through Paula, what our reps do. The work, the commitment, the support, the counselling, the solidarity, and the success they deliver for members. Day in, day out, week in, week out. The front line in our battle for justice. Paula, thank you for everything you've done for this union, and above all, for putting up with everything this union's thrown at us in the last 10 years. Comrades. Comrades, before us lie great opportunities and serious threats. Anti-terror laws which stifle media freedom, product placement, the economic crisis, all pose threats. The big cable and phone companies that control access to the internet want to be gatekeepers, deciding which websites and services can be used depending on which companies have paid them the most. They want to turn the open internet into a closed, private toll road. And yet new technologies, freed from the stifling constraints imposed by the market, offer us opportunities too. If we are to have public conversations essential to taking on serious dilemmas, from climate change to economic justice, we need forums for those conversations. The media can facilitate the conversations, or it can shut them down. They can open up or constrain our beliefs about what is possible, what is desirable, who is deserving, and which perspectives are legitimate. Serving democracy and nourishing the common good is, for the media, something that requires not only attacking corrupt secrecies in a society, but also defending non-corrupt communication. Day in, day out, we stand up for journalists, but we must never forget too that we have a historic mission on behalf of the public to stand up for journalism too. Thank you.
36.
That was Jeremy Deer, outgoing General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists, speaking this time last week up in Southport at the Union Conference. Now, Martin Summers is just joining me. Briefly, Martin, before the news, one of the most serious things that's come up, and Jeremy mentioned in his speech there, is this becoming clear now that the Metropolitan Police may have been paid, regularly paid, for stories by the Metropolitan Police, who were supposed to be investigating the News of the World at the same time. Now, isn't that a sort of conflict of interest there?
Definitely, and of course what we've got is a phenomenon of media magnates who are overmighty subjects. Think of Mr. Berlusconi. These people are becoming incredibly powerful because they are very, very wealthy and they control the means of communication. I mean, the classic case of overmighty subjects who need to be brought to, you know, they're too big for their boots and they need to be cut down to size.
Interestingly enough, Nick Davis, who gave the Bend lecture last year, actually no, 2009, November, here in Bristol, talked about this story. It seems to be running and running and running, so I'm sure it's not finished yet. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Stoke Bishop, Peter Abraham, to reporter Marina Morris, and guests, Australian child leukaemia paediatrician, Helen Caldicott, and of course to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week it's Good Friday. We'll be back with more politics and controversial investigations in the run-up to the AV referendum and the local elections. You will find this show and podcasts for previous shows on thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.
FM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody